When I was a small boy, 1,000 years ago, I used to love going to the Sunday flea market. Part of the attraction was its temporary nature. What was a car park for 6 days of the week was suddenly a bustling, very human environment come Sunday. Nobody talked about pop-ups at that time, but that's essentially what it was, a pop-up. Today, from retail to art to community engagement, the pop-up has come of age. But why are they so popular, and are they more than just a passing fad? They're the questions framing today's Future Tense. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome as always. And a little later in the show, we'll hear from sociologist Jonathan Wynn, who makes a pitch for the festivalisation of culture.
Museums and performing arts spaces are underutilized by the American population. Only about 12% of the cultural institutions that were surveyed over the last 10 years said that they had increased their attendance over the last few years. So we've been overproducing concrete culture at kind of a rapid rate, and some people have referred to that as being an edifice complex.
I guess one of the sort of core fundamentals of pop-ups is here today, gone tomorrow. So it's, you know, I'm in town now and I'm not going to be here forever. And it really harks back to those fairs and circuses in days of old.
Mikhail Carrington, lecturer in marketing, University of Melbourne.
Jeans retailers now in the Paris Fashion Week, New York Fashion Week, you see high-end fashion retailing and brands with pop-up stores popping up everywhere aligned with kind of the fashion shows and things like that. So you only have to walk down, you know, the beach in St Kilda and you'll see pop-up cafes all over the place. So pop-up really has become a modern phenomenon, and it's actually the fastest growing physical store format now globally.
So the temporary nature of a pop-up is alluring to us as consumers. Why is it alluring?
Okay, a couple of things. Firstly, as just human beings, we are variety seekers. So we tend to love a little bit of novelty. We love a bit of entertainment and variety. And so when our standard routines are disrupted by something that's fun, it's entertaining, it's different, perhaps, or it's just new and it's not something that I've seen before, it actually really plays upon that desire for novelties, desire for variety. And so that's one of the reasons pop-ups work really well. And one of the other reasons, I guess, pop-ups work really well is what's called fear of missing out. And it's a marketing phenomenon that we've known about for a long time, and you'll see it playing out in all sorts of forms of marketing and advertising. And it's that fear of, it's only going to be here for a week, or I've never seen it before and I don't know how long it's going to be here. I must go in and try that coffee, or I must go in and have a look at what this is all about because I might miss out.
Now, you argue, don't you, that pop-ups cut through the mechanisms that many of us have for shutting out the marketing noise of modern life. Could I get you to explain that for us?
So as human beings, we're really good at evolving to the environment around us. And so because of the past, I guess, 20, 30, 40 years, we've been as consumers so inundated by marketing messages, advertising, retailing advertising, we tend to shut a lot of that out now. And part of that is just trying to maintain a sense of sanity and not being constantly bombarded by this marketing, advertising and stimulus. And so what that means is that as consumers and as human beings, we've actually created a stimulus threshold that blocks out a lot of marketing, advertising and retailing. And so pop-ups are really, or can be, if done well, can be really disruptive. Pop-ups can really cut through the clutter, cut through our sensory thresholds and make consumers pay attention to whatever it is, whether it be a product offering or be a specific piece of communication or message that you want to get across.
And from the retailer's perspective, there is a sense, isn't there, in which they can dip their toes into a market and see
yes.
whether it's worth making a longer-term investment.
Absolutely. So there's a whole range of benefits for retailers and marketers around pop-up stores. And one of them is around flexible market testing and research. So I'll give you an example. And the example would be Uniqlo, a Japanese fast fashion retailer who came into the Australian market a few short years ago. When they came into the market, they were coming into the Melbourne market, they were opening up a new store, the first Australian store in the Emporium, which was going to be and is a relatively new shopping centre here in the centre of Melbourne. Before they opened up that big store in the Emporium, what they did was open up a little pop-up store just around the corner from the Bourke Street Mall. And the point of that pop-up store was, yes, about generating awareness of the retailer, starting to get people talking about Uniqlo, but also about testing the market. So Uniqlo have a very large market offering, particularly overseas in Japan. And I guess the question on their mind was, well, what do we actually offer the Australian market? And what do we offer the Melbourne market? Let's use a pop-up store to test the market to see what people in Melbourne like, what's their style, what's their fashion, what are the sort of items that are really pushing their buttons, and then we can use that to then set up our big store. So pop-up stores can be fast, flexible, real-time, and very, very cost-effective way of doing market research in a specific location.
One of the big trends, I suppose, that we've seen in retail in recent times has been, you know, a move away from the physical store towards online purchasing. How does the pop-up phenomenon, though, how do we read that in that context of the bigger change within retail?
So there are three really growing store formats or retail formats out there at the moment. Obviously online, although in certain retail sectors we are beginning to see online growth plateauing. And what we're really seeing the growth coming out of is mobile digital, which is not the same shopping platform is online, so people shopping with their smartphones, and pop-up stores. There is always going to be room for a physical shopping experience in people's lives. So as convenient as shopping online and shopping on your mobile phone is, for certain products and product categories, there's always going to be room for people wanting to actually touch and feel the product before they buy it. Experience the shopping, because shopping's more than just buying products. It's also about the experience. People see shopping as being a leisure activity these days. So yes, a lot of people are shopping online. A lot of people shopping with their smartphones. A lot of that activity online is actually research driven. So doing research before I go into the physical store to really cut down my research time in store, for example. So there is always going to be room for a physical store outlet. And as I said, we are beginning to see plateauing in growth of online. And so what retailers are really moving to now is what's called an omni-channel strategy, which is to say that we're not just going to be an online retailer, and we're not just going to be a physical store retailer. We're actually going to have a whole portfolio of different store formats. So small stores, big stores, online, mobile, digital, and pop-up stores. And the key role that pop-up stores play in that whole portfolio of your different store formats is around, number one, getting to the right target customer at the right time and really disrupting those routines. And that's quite important when you're talking about the younger generation. So we're talking about Generation Y, Generation Z, the millennials and the younger generations. And so they've grown up with the sense of the store comes to me. Yes, sometimes I love to go out shopping and I love that whole experience of shopping, but I want to do it in a way that works around me and my lifestyle. And so having a pop-up store offer enables you to take your store out to that customer and really target them where they're shopping or where they're not shopping, but you know, are open to shopping as part of their sort of everyday activities. Where retailers are getting the excitement and getting the growth is around small stores, flexible stores, mobile pop-up stores. And so this is just the beginning of the pop-up phenomenon. We are going to begin to see a lot more of these stores, but the way they will work is through being really flexible and actually being quite mobile. And so literally popping up where you least expect them.
Mikhail Carrington.
Over the summer, I first learned about Parking Day, which is a an event that takes a parking space and transforms it into a park for a day. And I thought that'd be that perfectly fit into what landscape architects do, our philosophies and our practice and our profession.
Parking Day is like a global pop-up awareness campaign. It's about rethinking urban space.
Parking Day originated, I understand, about 10 years ago in the US, and it was actually people turning up to a car parking space in the city, putting their money in the meter and then putting down some carpet and chairs and saying, we've got as much right to use this space as someone with a car, so let's, you know, pay for our parking time and take up the space and show what else could be done.
Belinda Ward is from a group called Space for Cycles. Her pop-up is in the city of Brisbane.
Okay, so we're standing in front of a protected bike lane. We've got two car parking spaces and we've taken that up and put down some green painted carpet to make this into a bi-directional bike lane. And to protect the bike lanes from the traffic, we've got a row of plants in planter boxes.
And you've even got an exercise bike here festooned with flowers at the front for people to hop on and have a pedal.
Exactly. I mean, as you can see, this is a very casual bike. It's very colourful. Some lovely flowers on the basket. This is the kind of bike that is comfortable to ride slowly, comfortably, in a relaxed position in your everyday clothes.
Now, for you, what's the benefit of Parking Day? Why come out here and take over a couple of car parks in the centre of a city?
Well, for a start, we don't think that actually storing cars on roads in the centre of the city is a very good use of CBD public space. So the opportunity to take over a couple of spaces that would normally just be used up by two cars and actually show what you could do with protected bike lanes is too good for us to turn down. So here we are with our bike lane and our flowers on Parking Day.
Belinda's pop-up is pretty straightforward. But in the very next parking space, there's a much more heavily constructed Parking Day pop-up made from sections of laser-cut cardboard. And this one was put together by a local firm. Christina Nahion Cho is our guide.
Our design ethos at Cox Architecture is about integrating structure, craft, art and nature. And whether that's in our bridge projects, in skyscrapers, interiors, or little pop-ups, we try and strive to integrate those kind of concepts. So when we decided to do Parking Day, we wanted to create kind of a engaging space that captured the parking space and invited people into it. And we did that by using digital technologies. So it's a program called Rhino and Grasshopper, and using algorithms to turn a digital kind of organic shape into a panelized construction system that we were able to get digitally fabricated and CNC routed. So as you can see here, there's over 400 individual panels that are interlocked together, and it's made from recycled cardboard. We've collaborated with Map and Nursery and tried to bring more green space into our installation. And during the course of the day, we'll be inviting members of the public to participate in a Kokedama workshop. And so during the course of the day, the people will be taking plants from the installation, making their own Kokedamas, and they'll be gifted those to take home and keep in their own homes.
And just in case you were wondering, a Kokedama is a Japanese hanging plant, where a ball of string is used to form the pot. The string is wound around the base of the plant, and that gives it a coconut shape. We give you all the facts here on this program. Now, at this point, we'll leave the streets of Brisbane for the streets of Melbourne. While Cox Architecture are creating pop-ups on a small scale, at the National Gallery of Victoria, they're experimenting with outdoor pop-up installations in a far grander fashion. Creating temporary pavilions has become a gallery craze in recent years. It started in London and is now a global phenomenon, with many of the world's major galleries now trying to outdo each other in scale and design. So, not to be outdone, the NGV recently opened its own temporary pavilion shaped like a car wash. ABC producer Simon Brown ventured forth on our behalf.
It's a glorious spring afternoon in Melbourne, and I'm out the back of the National Gallery of Victoria in the gardens, where they have a life-size replica of a car wash. One of the bays is spraying water mist, which the children are running in and out of.
My name is Ewan McKeown. I'm the Senior Curator of Contemporary Design and Architecture here at the National Gallery of Victoria.
Can you tell me about how this project started, the genesis of it?
Well, when we opened a Department of Contemporary Design and Architecture here last year, 2015, we started to look at how we might exhibit architecture in the context of the gallery. And one of the things that I realised was that we had this wonderful public space, the garden, and that it was being underutilised, perhaps, a bit of a secret spot in Melbourne, a fantastic space to exhibit work. And so in 2015, we started with the idea of commissioning a temporary pavilion, and then this turned into a national competition, which is ongoing.
Why a pop-up structure? Why is it temporary?
Normally, architecture is kind of constrained by its requirement of longevity. So there are financial, structural, planning constraints that come with architecture, which mean that it's very difficult to exhibit. You know, normally when one exhibits architecture in the context of a gallery, you're exhibiting models and drawings because you can't exhibit whole buildings. So what pavilions allow us to do is to create a free space within which to kind of explore something without those constraints. So a pavilion, a temporary structure, is by its nature simpler to organise and implement, but also it's freer intellectually because it's a process of discovery. So that's what this pavilion is here to do, is to allow, that's why it's an open competition. It allows people to explore an idea about architecture, something that engages with the public, something that's participatory, that's relates to the site and the context of an art gallery. But if it was permanent, we would only be able to do it once.
I'm Vivian Mitsogiani. I'm part of Matt Studio Architects.
You've taken something which is very suburban because it involves the car, and you've given people a chance to play in it. How important was it to provide that sense of exploration?
We started to think about pavilions as a type, and there have been quite a lot of them around, particularly internationally. And they give, I suppose, they give the opportunity to create a space and exhibit architecture in the gallery. So we thought about how people would use the pavilion and the space, and the idea of sort of joy, I think, became quite a big player. Once we started working on the object, looking at its materiality, we wanted, I think, what we call, or what I call, the uncertain object. So that really means something you don't just understand from one perspective. You've seen it, you understand it, but something that really encourages you to move around it. It shifts as you walk around the pavilion itself. The four layers of cricket netting starts to do particular, you know, cast particular shadows. It becomes very dense when you're far away, and it becomes incredibly porous as you get closer to it. So yes, engagement and having people actually participate in the project was a very big part of the idea.
I think what's very interesting in running this first one is that it will set the tone for the future in that what we're not talking about is architecture as object. So it's not just a form, it's not just a structure. There is a cultural discourse going on through this work in terms of what do we think about outer suburbia, what do we think about commercial environments in the suburbs, what do we think about the cultural impact that commercial logos and design typologies have on how they feed back into contemporary culture. And there's lots of layering in that, looking at Jeffrey Smart's work or looking at Arkley's work, you know, this drawing from suburbia. So what I anticipate is that the next round, when we run this competition again, the next round of proposals will be perhaps more thoughtful and perhaps delving deeper, and we'll get less and less. Over time, I think we can expect more challenging conceptual propositions and less and less just kind of object in the landscape, which is quite exciting for architects to know that we support the idea that architecture can be about a conversation and not just about a building.
And if you want to take a look at the National Gallery of Victoria's pop-up car wash pavilion, there's a link on the Future Tense website. Just search the words RN and Future Tense. If you live in Melbourne and you want to experience it firsthand, the pavilion will be open until April next year. Now, from a bricks and mortar institution experimenting with the temporary, to a man who'd like to see a lot more of the temporary and much less of the bricks and mortar. Jonathan Wynn is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
Cities have overinvested in sports stadiums and arts and cultural facilities over the last 30 years, I would say. We've invested a massive amount of public resources into sports stadiums. Just this year, the U.S. Bank Stadium in Minneapolis will receive about $50 million of public funding, about half of its cost. Atlanta, Georgia has the Mercedes-Benz Stadium, and that pocketed about $240 million of public funding as well. This is all sometimes done with a public vote. Sometimes it's just done by a vote of city council. Museums, performing arts spaces, and cultural facilities sadly don't look much better. And so there's been research on this from the Institute of Museum and Library Services that offered a kind of catchy statistic 2 years ago that said that the United States has more museums than all the Starbucks and McDonald's combined, which sounds really great, and it makes it sound like the United States is a very cultured place. But sadly, just like the sports stadiums that are left vacant for much of the year, museums and performing arts spaces are underutilized by the American population. Only about 12% of the cultural institutions that were surveyed over the last 10 years said that they had increased their attendance over the last few years. So we've been overproducing concrete culture at a kind of a rapid rate in the United States. And some people have said that that's what is referred to that as being a edifice complex.
So the problem here is that money is going into construction. It's going into infrastructure instead of being funneled into cultural activities or sporting or festival activities. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, it's been a choice that we've made. So there's been urban cultural policy that has been geared towards what I call concrete culture. And I try and say that there is a different tack that cities can take in the form of festivalization based around shorter term events that use existing facilities, existing structures, also using existing culture, existing communities that are already there and already present within the city.
And what are the advantages of that sort of festivalization approach then?
Well, one thing is that, as I said, it's already existing facilities that are there and available, but I think it offers a temporary and changeable cultural good that allows us to test out the investment in economic and non-economic resources and goods of a community. Is there interest? Should we offer more democratic participation in a particular event? If it doesn't work, if it doesn't enliven public space and shape and promote a local character that a city would like, well, we could scale it back, we could tone it down, we could cancel it. In Montreal, there's a fantastic festival called Pop Montreal that doesn't use a single space like a sports stadium or a gigantic park the way that maybe some of your listeners will think of as a music festival. Instead, they try and identify empty spaces, curious spaces that you wouldn't normally think of as being energized by music, and yet under a bridge or in a fire station or in a little alleyway, they place music throughout the city and they energize all these different aspects of the city, which I think is quite dynamic. And on the one hand, and if something doesn't work, the next year they can plot their festival in a different way. And so I think that there can be really creative ways of thinking about using temporary events to not just focus on a central park type place or a, you know, kind of out in a field in the case of the Woodstock that we might have in our mind, but instead using city spaces in creative ways.
But is that festival approach that you talk about, I mean, is that going to work, say, for you know, a gallery that specializes in high art?
Perhaps not. I suppose that you don't want to have art just scattered about in the city. There's something to be said for having a spatial concentration of these locations. So having it too scattered about would make little sense. At the same time, having it in one place might limit the benefits of a temporary event. And so I talk about the different ways that festivals kind of emplace themselves in cities. On the one hand, you've got a what I call a citadel model of just people going in and out of a kind of bounded space. The other one is I call a confetti model, where it's just scattered throughout the city. And then I call a core model something that's in between the Goldilocks, not too hot and not too cold. Maybe it uses a strip of honky-tonks in the case of Nashville, Tennessee, but also the sports stadium and also the convention center that are proximate to that. So you have a kind of adaptation of different spaces and some flexibility therein. And I don't say that that's necessarily the best model, but it does seem to be a pretty good model that works well for the city that it's in Nashville.
Now, there has been traditionally prestige and status attached to permanent public structures, particularly permanent cultural structures. Is that part of the problem here? Do we feel like we need to have these permanent structures in order to be, you know, a real city?
I think that that's very well the case, and I think that that's the strategy that cities try and promote. And certainly if we focus on something like the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, we can point to the successes. But there are also failures of museums that haven't lived up to the billing and haven't been able to live up to the expectations as far as attendance and as far as draw.
So you argue that temporary festivals could be an alternative to this very concrete, fixed way in which we think about cultural institutions. You're not suggesting that temporary festivals should be a complete replacement for those permanent institutions, are you?
Absolutely not. What I do think is that it might be a nice way to test out whether there's an audience for a particular institution, whether it's a small arts facility or a performing arts space. I think that it could be great to offer these short-term events to test the waters, to see where things work, to where you can get an audience to be attracted to a particular location. And if anything, I see it might be a good preliminary stage before moving to a more concrete and fixed culture. And so I'm not making a call for stopping all concrete culture, perhaps just putting a pause on it.
Overcoming the Edifice Complex. Jonathan Wynne there from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Next week on Future Tense, we take you to the deserts of the Middle East.
En Gedi is a town on the shore of the Dead Sea, not from Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were actually found. It's a desert oasis, so it's very famous for the springs there. It actually appears in the Bible. It's mentioned that Saul and King David were hiding in caves and refreshing in the springs at En Gedi.
After over four decades, an ancient puzzle is solved.
When the ancient Jewish village of En Gedi, dating back from the Byzantine period, was completely destroyed by fire, it's likely none of the survivors ever returned to claim their property. When archaeological excavations began on the village site, charred scroll fragments were discovered in a burned-out synagogue.
Considered the new technology developed to read the unreadable. That's next week on Future Tense. Thanks to my co-producer, Edwina Stott, and to Simon Brown for taking us through the car wash at the NGV in Melbourne. This week's sound engineer was Steve Fieldhouse. If you want to have your say or you want to leave us a message, social media is always good. Just search us out on Twitter. RN Future Tense is our Twitter handle. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.